Welcome to episode 35 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my guest is Michael Belazzo, a comedian and writer and the co-host of the Landlord and Tenant Pod Mess. Michael, welcome to Junk Filter.
Thanks for having me, Jesse. This is exciting. I've spent the last 48 hours doing meticulous research and having a nice time.
Michael and I are both big fans of David Bowie, and I've asked him to join me for a discussion of one of the most bizarre periods of his career. His life in the mid-1970s, a fertile creative period that took a great toll on him. We'll also be talking about the connection between a revealing BBC documentary about his American concert tour, Cracked Actor, his big screen debut in Nicholas Roeg's The Man Who Fell to Earth, and the next two albums Bowie released in the wake of this film, Station to Station and Low. What an adventure to relive the Bowie years. This is like the part of the Bowie career that I'm most interested in. It's insane that he lived through it.
Just watching Cracked Actor, he looks a little healthier in The Man Who Fell to Earth, but not much. But watching Cracked Actor, it is amazing that he doesn't pass away on screen in every scene, because he looks so sick. I was watching it again the other night, and I thought, he looks like a man who has escaped from a hospice and jumped into the back of a limousine. Not a healthy man.
Bowie was like a very famous person, but nobody really knew anything about him. He had kept his private life very private. And this documentary, Cracked Actor, a film about David Bowie, was directed by Alan Yentob, and it premiered on the BBC's Omnibus program in January of 1975. The film became part of Bowie's legacy and icon status because it was quite revealing. It was the first time that people actually got to find out anything really about him. He always kept his guard up in interviews, but this is a very unguarded portrayal of him. Such a wonderful person. But you got problems. The documentary crew followed him as he went through Hollywood and LA on the Diamond Dogs tour. Oh, and by the way, he didn't fly to the United States, right, Michael?
No, he had a fear of flying, and so he took a ship across from Britain to America, and then a limo, I guess, going west from New York across America, so that he could stay safe, so he could be alive and healthy to nearly kill himself every day with cocaine.
This is a quote from the director of the documentary. I'd caught him at what was an intensely creative time, but it was also physically and emotionally grueling. Our encounters tended to take place in hotel rooms in the early hours of the morning or in snatched conversations in the back of limousines. He was fragile and exhausted, but also prepared to open up and talk in a way that he had never really done before. Right off the bat, you know that Bowie is a mess. In the very first few minutes of the documentary, Bowie's in the back seat with a carton of milk. And he mentions casually that there's a fly floating around in the milk.
Yes, that's a famous scene where he looks like a vampire or a man who escaped from a hospice. And I guess he's comparing his experiences in America to being a foreign body floating around in milk, just like the fly. And he's absorbing a lot of milk. I guess that means he's absorbing a lot of American culture, which he is. He's actually, I think in that scene, he's singing along to Aretha Franklin. And I guess throughout this documentary, you see him sort of absorbing American soul and R&B. But it's a weird, weird comparison to make.
There's also a funny part where he sees a wax museum in the middle of the desert.
Yes, he can't believe it.
He says, you'd think it would melt, wouldn't you?
I guess he didn't. I guess Britain probably didn't have air conditioning back in the early 70s. Like, it was almost a third world country at that time. So they probably didn't have, you know, modern amenities like air conditioning.
This film is, I would say it's about 20 minutes of it is behind the scenes of Bowie's life, and about 40 minutes of it is tour footage. The tour looks incredible. It was the Diamond Dogs tour.
Yes, the Diamond Dogs tour, I guess 1974. We were talking before we recorded, I guess, that this was at the time the most elaborate and expensive rock tour ever staged. It had an unwieldy set that weighed like 6 tons, that cost like $1.5 million. They had multiple trucks carting it across America and had all these pieces that were, because it was very highly rehearsed and choreographed. A lot of the pieces used, like there's a cherry picker and like he's sitting in a hand at one point. The cherry picker would often break when he was up at the top of the stadium on top of his fans singing. And different things, like there was a catwalk that collapsed also when he was singing, I think, on the opening night. So it was full of danger for young David Bowie. And I think the tour, it also kicked off in Montreal.
Do you think that maybe Radio Canada did a French version of Crack Doctor?
Maybe. I mean, hopefully it'd be neat to see how they would. Quebec loves doing their versions of popular shows like SNL Quebec and Family Feud Quebec. So maybe they did a Cracked Actor Quebec, yeah.
I would like to discuss the tantalizing footage that is in this documentary of his fans.
Oh, the fans, the clean-cut, enthusiastic young American teens who are huge fans of David Bowie, and they sit around gushing about how they love him and his different personas and how he's like the king of rock. Yes, it's very, very innocent. And to what we know now about, you know, what David Bowie was like during that era, it is amazing that they have no clue.
I think we all feel the same way, don't we? I mean, yeah. It's pretty...
Music in general is an important part of all our lives.
Yeah, exactly.
We're big rock fans.
And Bowie we thought was the best.
God.
He intentionally keeps himself a mystery.
Yeah, right.
Because he's always being somebody else on stage or trying to be somebody else on stage. And he keeps his own personality a complete mystery. So it adds to the aura and makes him a more interesting person.
It is like they're the Riverdale teens. Like there's a guy in a yellow shirt with like a blonde mullet and his friends. And I guess they're teens, but they do look like they're in their 30s in that way that when you look at pictures of teenagers from the olden days, everyone seems to be middle-aged.
That's a problem in America, though. Like, in America, I find that a lot of people age rapidly. Like, you can be 20 years old, but you can look 35.
I guess. Yeah, maybe these teens, they've had a hard life, and the only solace they have is the music of David Bowie.
I want to see a documentary about the filmmaker trying to find Bowie fans for the documentary. Because these four guys that he rounded up just seem so random. Like, they found some guys at an arcade and asked them if they liked Bowie.
They're actually, like, all the fans they show in Cracked Actor are pretty dorky. Like, you see these teens, the clean-cut teens, and then you see the sort of glam carnival fans who are like dressed up as mimes and like wizards and magicians. And there's one guy who I think I tweeted a picture of today who there's a cutaway outside of a Bowie concert where there's this sort of fat guy with curly hair and he has a painted face like green and red. And he just says like, I like people who are AC/DC. Know what I mean? And he looks like John Candy as Harry, the guy with the snake on his face.
He also looks like he's 34 as well.
David Bowie swept America. He beguiled the 45-year-old music fans from coast to coast.
My notes, I wrote David Bowie parking lot for this part.
Did you? I made a note of there's one guy who's clearly a teen who is under the influence of some sort of drug. And the director is like, oh, do you like David Bowie? And he's like, yeah, he's the center of the universe, man. And then the follow-up question is like, and what universe is that? And there's a pause and the teen just says, I'm just from Phoenix. I came here. But it's funny to see these young, innocent American fans of David Bowie. But while I was watching it, I thought they're actually like, you know, kind of brave, because at the time in 1974, like what was in the charts, like the Eagles and Lynyrd Skynyrd and like kind of that country rock kind of denim and beard, mm-hmm. In some cases, Confederate flag waving kind of rock that is very like set in a set in a form of masculinity of like, yeah, like men dressing like lumberjacks. And you have these weird teens dressed as wizards and magicians and like Harry, the guy with the snake on his face. And they must have gotten a lot of abuse from people at the time.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was kind of brave in the 70s to be sort of like a Bowie fan, and with the sort of theatricality that comes with really, really being into it, that sort of puts you as a target in some parts of the US, I'm sure.
And it's amazing that Bowie connected, because this documentary is leading up to his, I guess, big breakthrough with like young Americans and fame going to number one. But it is wild that in that era of America, like the Vietnam War is still going on, you have kind of these guys with denim and beards, and this depraved, drug-addicted, bisexual rock star who is talking about like masks and mime and kabuki theater and singing Jacques Brel songs suddenly becomes the biggest star in the country.
I was thinking when he was doing My Death of all the sort of rocker fans in there being forced to listen to a Jacques Brel song.
And so many of the songs are about death, like Rock and Roll Suicide, Time, My Death. Like, it is not uplifting music, but it but it connected.
Bowie was really, really trying to bring back all sorts of stuff in the 70s. Cabaret, mimes, Jacques Brel.
So there is David Bowie did have a somewhat extensive background in mime. He trained under Lindsay Kemp, who was an actor and teacher who most people would probably know from, most people who aren't in, you know, deep in the mime community would know him from The Wicker Man. He plays the pub landlord who is very, he has the daughter that I guess the inspector is seduced by or whatever. And Lindsay Kemp trained David Bowie in mime, and Bowie was super into it. And there's an amazing story that in 1969, T-Rex, Mark Bolan and Bowie had been friends since they were teenagers, and T-Rex was going on tour across the UK, and Mark Bolan specifically asked Bowie to be their opening act, not doing music, but doing 1 minute of mime. And that, just the 1 minute, from what I was reading online, the crowds across the UK universally despised it, and he'd be heckled mercilessly and things thrown at him. And I'm sort of on the side of the audience in this one. He was obsessed with bringing mime to rock in a way that no one before or after really has done.
I noticed a lot of mimery in The Man Who Fell to Earth as well.
There's one scene where he's walking down the hall when he's trying to see if he can escape from that weird hospital hotel where he's been imprisoned, where it does look like he's doing some sort of mime moves as he's like surreptitiously going down the hall. I guess mime never, in the end, he just wanted to be a mime, and he had to get there through becoming a huge rock star. I wonder if anyone at any of those T-Rex shows was inspired to like, hey, I found out this just blew my mind. This is what I want to do now. I want to be a damn mime. And that must have been Mark Bolan kind of fucking with him, because they did have a competitive sort of relationship where obviously T-Rex blew up before David Bowie did. So it's kind of, part of me wonders whether Mark Bolan was setting up his friend to fail every night on their tour.
Just programming him to be a mime to sabotage his career.
Hey, David, there's a big agent here tonight in the crowd. You should do. Might be your night to get discovered.
He's looking for a mime, David.
Yes, but he would do an extended mime routine, apparently, during the sort of experimental piano part of Aladdin Sane every night during the Diamond Dogs tour.
So a leitmotif in Cracked Actor is that David Bowie's trying to put the character of Ziggy Stardust behind him.
Right, yes. He, in a few of the cutaway interviews, he talks about his fear during this time. Like, he's explaining why he killed Ziggy Stardust. At that, I guess it's captured in that documentary by D.A. Pennybaker. And he talks about how he had this fear that the Ziggy character was slowly overtaking him, and he didn't know at one point, you know, if he was writing it or if Ziggy was writing him, and he was dealing with schizophrenia. And he does have a history in interviews of talking about how there was a sort of like genetically disposed to mental illness. His half brother Terry had been institutionalized, so he had this like fear constantly of like losing his mind. But I think the biggest problem in all this is the amount of cocaine he was doing by purposely giving himself cocaine psychosis, and it might have less to do with him playing a character than his massive intake of drugs. Just an idea. Yeah. And then even his fans are like, yeah, he's, you know, he had to kill off Ziggy because, you know, it's like the lyrics, like when the kids had killed the man, I had to break up the band. And I feel like this all was much simpler than anyone thought.
Let's also talk about the limo driver in this movie.
In Cracked Actor, Bowie's being chauffeured around LA and America by his limo driver / bodyguard, who was a Bronx native, a guy named Tony Mascia, I don't know how to say it, who he was also cast as the limo driver in The Man Who Fell to Earth. And apparently they got along very well, an unlikely sort of friendship of, again, this guy, a deranged drug addict, depraved guy into avant-garde, you know, William S. Burroughs and Jacques Brel. He became very close friends with Bowie, to the point that Tony Mascia, this Bronx man, had Bowie as the best man at his wedding. And there are pictures online of this, I guess, traditional Italian Bronx wedding where you see David Bowie there. Also, Iggy Pop is there. And just imagining these two like drug-addled freaks showing up to like chat with Nona is an amazing idea.
So Cracked Actor can be viewed on the internet. It showed in 1975 on the BBC. They never showed it again until the 90s. And it got bootlegged a lot. So VHS tapes circulated. But now you can find it on Daily Motion. And it's an incredible document of the Diamond Dogs tour and of the state of Bowie. But what makes this documentary even more remarkable is that Nicholas Rogue was working on casting The Man Who Fell to Earth, his sci-fi film. He was considering Peter O'Toole. He was also considering Michael Crichton, the guy who wrote Jurassic Park, mostly because he was 6'10". So he wanted a freakishly tall guy. But like, can you imagine The Man Who Fell to Earth starring Michael Crichton?
I mean, that would have been a entirely different and very funny movie to watch, especially when you think about some of the sex scenes in The Man Who Fell to Earth. Because it would be, I wonder how Michael Crichton would have done some of that stuff. But yeah, it's interesting that the only requirement was they wanted a tall guy. Cause they, in that case, Nicholas Rogue could have cast like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar as, if they're just looking for a tall guy.
A casting director insisted that Rogue watch this documentary, Cracked Actor. And Rogue just saw the footage of Bowie wasted in the backseat of the limousine, looking like a Martian, and said, well, there's our leading man. Rogue convinced Bowie to take the lead in his first acting role. Hilariously, Bowie forgot about their first meeting, and Rogue was like waiting in his apartment for like 8 hours until he finally stumbled in at 5 a.m.
Yeah.
And immediately said, I'll do the film. Like he was into doing it. He was impressed that Rogue stayed up all night to wait to talk to him. But
and apparently he hadn't even read the script, but he agreed to do it. And it was unknown whether he'd even show up on the set, but he came early and he knew all his lines. So, you know.
So did you know that not only did they get the chauffeur from Cracked Actor to be in the Man of Fell to Earth, but that's also the limousine.
Oh, the same limousine.
Yeah, I found out it's the same limousine too.
And it looks like he's wearing some of the same clothes, like that wide-brimmed hat and the black suit where he sort of looks like a bit of a witch.
Just a quick digression. Before The Man Who Fell to Earth was made, Bowie was tinkering with entering the film world on his own. I found out that he wrote a screenplay called Diamond Dogs, and it was intended for Terrence Stamp playing father to Iggy Pop and Bowie directing.
Now, that would have been an amazing movie. Right. And I wonder if some of those ideas found their way into like the Diamond Dogs stage show or the songs. Probably. Like, I wonder if Hunger City was still the setting, like in Diamond Dogs.
Quite possibly.
And the character of Halloween Jack, Halloween Jack, one of the lesser known, less celebrated Bowie personas. It's Bowie when he had like orange hair and basically just a pirate patch. And that was the whole character briefly mentioned in one song and then never heard from again. But, you know, to me, that's one of the strongest personas.
The other thing is that we have to talk about the lunacy that Bowie was experiencing in the mid 70s, because, you know, his drug abuse was reaching such levels that he agreed to be on a variety show with Cher doing a medley of Young Americans and then all these other random songs. Have you seen that?
I just watched it today for the first time in a few years, and it is amazing. It's like an amazing, you know, time capsule of that time. But I think they fit like 30 songs or 40 songs in like 6 minutes. And it just seems like, yes, it was an idea done on like, yeah, 10 grams of cocaine. It's just one, like one song after another for 6 minutes. It's really good. This is the step that cuts his hand, showing nothing swoops like a song blue. Everybody knows one. Looks great. He looks great. They both sound good. But it is also interesting to see that he could do that sort of variety show performance and also be into like super avant-garde art of the time.
It was like a different showbiz world back then too. Like in the mid 70s, like Bowie went on the Dinah Shore program to promote Station to Station. That aired at like 9 a.m. for Housewives.
The Housewives of America are head over heels in love with the thin white Duke. He's throwing darts in lovers' eyes today on the Dinah Shore show.
Will he be wild as the wind in the kitchen as well as the stage? Find out in our cooking segment.
I wonder if he told Dinah Shore that he didn't remember recording the album that he was on her show to promote, or if he sort of skipped over that part.
Also, Bowie in interviews at the time was so coked out that he was proclaiming his admiration for Adolf Hitler.
Not a great strategy for promoting a new album, I'll say. But, you know, considering the times, I guess it was a different era and they let that slide. But yeah, that was, I guess, around the time where he was, from what I read, doing up to 10 grams of medicinal quality, like pharmaceutical cocaine, which I didn't know was a thing, that existed. But he, yes, he's very jumpy in these interviews, and it almost ended his life, but it also made him so productive during that time, while also getting him involved in like black magic and sort of dabbling with Satanism.
Yeah, and fascism too. Like another thing that he said at one point is that he wanted to see a right-wing, totally dictatorial tyranny. So, you know, now he'd be out every Saturday in Toronto at the No More Lockdowns marches.
Yeah, like 1975, David Bowie would have been an anti-masker. He would have been like one of those like hugs over masks guys.
Mimes over masks.
But an interesting thing too, though, is just for a second to go back to Cracked Actor. I mean, the name of the documentary, obviously from a song, would make you think that he's like, you know, he's completely out of his mind and deranged, but he is, for a man under the influence of that much drugs, he's surprisingly coherent and articulate, and pretty like he pretty clearly explains what he's up to artistically. So I guess he was a guy who didn't, I don't know, cocaine did make him more productive, and I've said this before, but that documentary and even this movie, The Man Who Fell to Earth, are almost like an ad for like the positive side of cocaine.
At the same time, there is that one moment in Cracked Actor where he thinks the cops are after him.
Right.
Where he's really, really jumpy and wiry, and he's very clearly coked out at that point. And also, the documentary never comes out and says that he's doing coke. It's just obvious.
Yes.
This is why now you could never make a movie like Cracked Actor.
I do wonder how many like shots were ruined, or if they had, how much they had to edit out of him just straight up, you know, doing a line in the middle of answering a question, because apparently his addiction became so normal to him that when he was dating one of his backup singers, he met her parents. I think it's, what's her name? Ava Cherry.
Yes.
He just, during dinner with her parents, just did a line of cocaine on the table in front of them, which is not a good way to ingratiate yourself to your new girlfriend's parents.
They didn't get married, so maybe he did wreck everything that day. Let's move on to The Man Who Fell to Earth in some detail. I hadn't seen this movie in a few years. It has aged so well.
Yeah, it really has, in a way that a lot of movies from that time don't hold up. But yeah, I've seen it now, I think, 3 or 4 times, and every time I see it, I like it more.
Are you the first?
The first what? Visitor? I've always been visited.
Nothing you have seen or heard about David Bowie will prepare you for the impact of his first dramatic performance in The Man Who Fell to Earth. This is another dimension of David Bowie, one of the few true originals of our time.
You're really a freak. I don't mean that unkindly. I like freaks.
It's always interesting to see 70s science fiction made just before Star Wars, and the sort of the ideas of telling science fiction stories were changed forever, I think, for movies once Star Wars showed up. But you have things like The Man Who Fell to Earth and Logan's Run, which were made just before, and they're super 70s, but for some reason they're not dated. They are, their 70s-ness is part of what makes them such good science fiction.
Right. I wonder if part of what protects The Man Who Fell to Earth from aging badly is that it doesn't really, in a way that a lot of older science fiction movies, it doesn't rely so much on like futuristic looking technology that they think is going to exist that actually ends up looking clunky. Mm-hmm. It has very little technology, and it's more about just this lonely alien on the Earth. I think the only technology we see is he develops a color Polaroid camera. Yeah. and a stereo system that instead of records, it plays these like orbs that contain music, which does look pretty cool.
Well, I thought the World Enterprises Corporation reminded me a lot of Apple.
Oh,
the sort of like domination of, Amazon too. Just running the entire planet. And I love the social satire that's built in with The Man Who Fell to Earth, which is, you know, the long story short is that David Bowie plays an alien from another planet who comes to Earth to get water for his planet to save his family. And he basically runs the table in the United States. Like, he makes the money that you need to make to get what you want in the consumer society. So he introduces all these new patents and makes so much money off that, that he can build a spaceship to go back to his home planet. But by that point, the government and the financial sectors basically interfere with him. And it's suggested that they knew all along that he was an alien. And they basically stop him. But we have no sense over the course of the movie how long this story has been taking place, because we see other Earth characters aging, but he never ages. But yet we're still in the 70s. Like, there's no new futuristic world that is created from this. Everything is about the same. We don't seem to be in the future in this movie at any point.
No, that's right. Even though decades seem to have gone by, because you see the characters like Mary Lou or what's Rip Torn's character's name? Bryce?
Yeah, Bryce.
They age quite a lot in the movie, and Bowie stays, his character Newton stays the same age. But yeah, nothing else indicates, you know, that we're in a future time.
So it's a film about exploitation. I mean, Bowie's exploitation of Earth is a fairly benevolent one, all told. Like, he's introducing new technologies. He's not trying to conquer the Earth. He's trying to use its resources, and he's exploiting, you know, the consumer society the way that he can, and very successfully for the longest time in the film. I did find this very funny article that I wanted to discuss with you on the internet. 10 business lessons from The Man Who Fell to Earth. I'd like to get your thoughts on some of these suggestions here. I might not do all 10, but here are some 10 of Newton's laws of business with takeaways for 21st century creative entrepreneurs. Michael, what do you think about business plans based on The Man Who Fell to Earth as a general concept?
Well, given that the movie ends in absolute failure and loneliness and the death of David Bowie's character's family on a distant planet, I'd say it's not the greatest movie to take business lessons from, and that the government takes away his business from him and murders his business partners. Yeah.
Some of the tips include: when you enter a new market, bring something radically new to the table. I guess that's the new technologies that he brings with World Enterprises Corporation. Don't get attached to your individual projects. Exploit intellectual property to extract the maximum value from your creativity via patents, licensing, and leveraging your trademark.
I like just the brain that you have to see a movie, like sort of experimental art movie, like The Man Who Fell to Earth, and think like, wow, this is, I'm getting some really amazing business tips from this. Like, imagine writing like business tips, like, here are the tips I gleaned from, from like the discreet charm of the bourgeoisie.
I won't do the whole thing. It also says fly your own spaceship. In one of the most Branson-esque sequences of the film, Newton is driven through a frenzied crowd who have come to watch him take off in his company's spaceship. This is the kind of PR stunt that generates priceless word of mouth.
I guess it does, yes. But again, the government prevents him from making the flight, and then he's incarcerated and is subjected to a lot of medical tests that ruin his eyesight.
Yeah, they use X-rays on his contact lenses and fuse them to his you know, alien eyeballs. So now he can't communicate to his home planet anymore. And he doesn't have the special vision that he once had.
It's just the ultimate example of rudeness. But yeah, I can't imagine anyone reading these business tips and thinking that, you know, and implementing them or thinking they're good.
Well, here's the funny one. The final one. No guarantees. I won't spoil the film by telling you how Thomas Newton's adventure ends, but you can probably guess it wouldn't be much of a movie if everything went smoothly.
True.
So the takeaway here is, when you set out in a spaceship, there's no guarantee of a soft landing or a happy ending, but that's part of the appeal.
Yeah, you might end up just a lonely alien alcoholic releasing a record at the end, you know, at the end of your life.
That was a deeply sad scene. Oh.
Yeah. I was sad, though. I guess we're getting ahead of ourselves, but it ends with his character, Bowie's character, releasing a record that he hopes will be played on the radio to contact his distant family. And we don't get to hear the music, which I wish they had played a snatch of his alien music.
I was reading an article about the making of the film, and apparently they cut out all references to time in this film. Any line of dialogue that had a time reference was removed, which is one way that we know that time is passing, but people age drastically from scene to scene as the film continues. It's very, very subtle and effective.
I did see there's a quote that Nicholas Rogue said that he wanted to take away the, as he called it, the crutch of time, which the audience holds on to. And he wanted to sort of make a movie that mirrored real life itself, where there's sort of, it just flows and there's no, you can't tell what the story is, basically. Like at the end of someone's life, like there's not a through line like you'd expect in a movie. And I think that approach to making the movie may have explained why it didn't really connect with viewers. It's kind of made in an elliptical way. It sort of cuts around. It doesn't sort of fill in the usual plot information that a lot of, you know, successful movies just provide for the audience. And the movie did not do well, as far as I know.
Well, it also had a botched release. It was initially produced by Paramount, but they pulled out when they saw it. I think they were expecting something more audience friendly, and sort of maybe they were expecting a more conventional science fiction film, not the sort of lurid and graphic results, and with the fractured editing style. So it was very confusing for a random viewer. I guess they had a different idea of the project they greenlit, so they actually pulled out. They were replaced by a company called British Lion, and they actually also panicked and cut 22 minutes out of the movie for the US.
Yeah, so for a movie,
that made the movie even more confusing for audiences.
Right, because the full-length version is a little hard to follow, I think, the first time you see it to begin with. I can't imagine what it... How you try and understand it with those 22 minutes missing. And I guess that sealed its fate, that in America anyway.
Well, the whole second sex scene between Candy Clark and David Bowie was removed outright.
Oh, the gun sex scene?
The gun stuff, yeah.
Where it starts, I think the first time we see him with this gun, he's stirring his glass of wine with a gun, as you do. And then he... licks off some of the excess wine from the gun. Yeah. Well, it must have been when the studios saw the finished product and they thought, like, hey, here's this famous rock star. He's like the hottest rock star on the planet. And then they see this sort of hard to follow impressionistic science fiction movie where David Bowie doesn't even sing. It must have been, hard for them to get enthusiastic about it.
There's really only one part where he sings, and that's that strange scene where he went to church.
Right.
With his girlfriend. And they were singing an English hymn, I believe. And that's supposed to be a suspenseful scene, and it was for British audiences. Because One of the funny things that Rogue said about the whole conceit of the man who fell to Earth is that it was deliberate that the alien spoke with a British accent because Americans just assume that all Brits are weirdos. So that would like buy the character some space to be a weirdo because Americans, you know, that's what they expect from a Brit. So in that scene, Bowie is, Newton is supposed to be panicking when he's required to sing a song that if he actually was a boy in Britain, he would know. And he has to sort of bluff his way through those lines. American audiences didn't understand that little thing because they already have their ideas about Brit. So that scene didn't play at all in America. They were like, why is he nervous?
Yeah, I didn't get that at all. It's similar then to the scene where, I guess we haven't talked about some of the other actors in the movie. Rip Torn plays a sexy, is he a college professor or a high school professor?
Yeah,
he's a college professor of science who's having sex with his students. And he, in that one scene where they're in that pod, that is actually where they shot the cover for Station to Station. Rip Torn says the RAF's like Latin motto, and Bowie doesn't know it, and it's like a weird moment because he's supposed to be British and doesn't know the motto.
Yeah, the Royal Air Force's motto is per ardua ad astra, through difficulties to the stars. Newton doesn't know that, and I guess that sort of tips off Rip Torn that he has suspicions about who this guy really is.
Watching, especially once he falls into the government's hands in The Man Who Fell to Earth, I thought that this entire movie is almost like setting the stage for Alf. I thought there's like a world where this inspired, what's his name, who created Alf? Jerry
Stahl.
Jerry, the permanent midnight man, where he saw The Man Who Fell to Earth and was like, excellent, but what if instead of David Bowie, there's a furry little sarcastic alien man who likes to eat cats? Because Bowie doesn't like to eat cats in The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Let's talk also about Buck Henry.
When I made a note watching it last night, when Buck Henry appears, so he's the patent lawyer that Newton contacts to handle his business with all this like otherworldly technology that's going to help him make hundreds of millions of dollars. And we first see Buck Henry, and throughout the entire movie, he's wearing these insanely thick, like Coke bottle glasses that make him look like Bubbles from Trailer Park or like Marty Feldman or something. And I just wrote down glasses. Why? Like it's not explained. It's just sort of this weird visual joke that doesn't have any payoff. doesn't go anywhere.
It's just, I just chalk it up to Rogue's tendency to just throw lots of imagery at you and memorable shots of faces and things like that. It's just another distancing device too, with the more lenses and glasses on the screen, you know,
right.
Like it makes the character look vaguely ridiculous for sure. But I was very blown away by the scene where the corporate bloodletting begins and they throw him out of his apartment.
Yes. They sort of,
these two guys put on like football helmets and throw him out of his apartment. Oh my God.
Yeah. And his sort of weightlifter boyfriend. They both end up on the pavement of New York City. Yeah.
The music in that scene is incredible. That's John Phillips' music, by the way.
Right. Is it, I guess the soundtrack for this movie has a huge backstory where originally Bowie signed on to act in The Man Who Fell to Earth and also to, I believe, do the soundtrack. But due to a number of reasons, I guess exhaustion, cocaine addiction, and musical sort of commitments he had for like an album, he delivered just like a few songs way late in the game, and they didn't sort of score it to picture, and they didn't work. So in a hurry, they turned to John Phillips to do the soundtrack.
And in fact, Rogue had offered Phillips's wife, the singer Genevieve Waite, the role of Mary Lou that went to Candy Clark, who, by the way, Nicholas Rogue was also dating.
Ah, and she's amazing. Every time I see it, I love her performance, and it's so sad to watch her decline. It's really tragic because she's so like innocent and like nice at the beginning, and you just see how she's destroyed by accidentally falling in love with this alien who can't sort of reciprocate.
Yeah, and they have one of the all-time bad dates gone wrong.
Are you talking about where they have a fight and he sort of like she tells him she's sick of him, and then he like sort of flips a freshly baked tray of cookies in the air in slow motion? And then she's pissed, and then how do you win an argument, guys? You go into the bathroom and you unzip your human costume and reveal that you're an alien man.
And then go lie down on the bed with no genitals. She freaks out, as most women would.
Yes.
A natural response, I would say, to finding out that the guy you love is actually a bug alien creature.
It's every gal's worst nightmare. But watching the flipping of the tray of cookies, I thought, is this Nicholas Rogue like making fun of Kubrick, like a Space Odyssey kind of moment of like the stick and the monolith and stuff?
This is from a very funny article in The Guardian by Chris Campion, the story about why this movie never had an official soundtrack until recently. Nicholas Rogue had offered Genevieve Waite the role of Mary Lou in The Man Who Fell to Earth, but John Phillips said no because he had written his own sci-fi themed rock musical for his wife to star in called Space. John said, Genevieve's going to be working on the Broadway show. And he and Nick Rogue were so drunk that they had this terrible fight and knocked over tables and stuff. Graham Clifford, who edited The Man Who Fell to Earth, said, those kinds of episodes with Nick were relatively, I wouldn't say frequent, but they were not infrequent. Everyone who knows Nick at one point or another has gotten to a rolling around on the floor fight with him. Which I had no idea. I always thought of Nicholas Rogue as being this sort of, you know, very serious British gentleman, like a Ridley Scott kind of, you know, unknowable, you know, creative who never talks about himself and just makes the work. But I'm reading in these stories that he was a barroom brawler like Oliver Reed.
And hearing that story, to think of like, okay, Nicholas Rogue, now he's a like a drunk barroom brawler. You've got David Bowie out of his mind on pharmaceutical cocaine, and they turn to like absolute mess and heroin addict John Phillips to help them with the movie. It's a miracle that anything got done, that they managed to finish this movie or you know, to create anything at all.
So this is another excerpt from this article. So John Phillips was basically doing coke the whole time in the studio and not doing any actual work. The final session for the score took place in February with the film's world premiere at Leicester Square in London, now just 3 weeks away. Phillips began to mix the tracks so they could be laid into the edit. At that point, said the engineer, he could hear clicks and noises on the tape, and despite the engineer's insistence that there was nothing there, insisted they do everything over. But the problem persisted. By the fourth or fifth... I'm cracking myself up. By the fourth or fifth day... things were pretty tense between them. Then something snapped. He fired the engineer and replaced him. And the projectionist went into the toilets, and all he could hear was somebody in the cubicle next to him sniffing. The bathroom breaks Phillips had been taking almost at the end of every take suddenly made sense. So they had to call Nick Rogue to come down to the studio. to have a serious discussion with John Phillips.
I like the idea that, like, okay, and that's a take. I got to take another dump. I'll be right back. It's like, yeah, he sniffed himself into cocaine psychosis to the point where he was hearing clicks and ghosts in the music that weren't there. Amazing.
It took 5 days to reach a breaking point.
Yeah. I also read another article about the soundtrack that also mentioned the John Phillips outer space sci-fi musical. I think, yeah, it was called Space.
Yeah.
And apparently it was like workshopped in Greenwich Village and played for like one night and then got just like panned by all the reviewers in New York. And a few years later, John Phillips claimed that George Lucas stole the idea for Star Wars from the musical Space that he wrote.
Did you ever see the documentary called Straight Shooter about John Phillips? It's incredible.
No.
It was made for Canadian pay TV, but it has so much incredible footage of him being a monster.
Oh, God. And it was made for Canadian pay TV.
Yeah. It ends as an infomercial for how great John Phillips is, but about an hour of it is really incriminating footage of what an asshole he was.
Jeez. Yeah, he was just a monster. But hey, you know, still a great job on the Man Who Fell to Earth soundtrack.
Well, apparently Rogue wanted the score to have an American twang to it. He didn't really like the sort of gloomy instrumental stuff that Bowie was working on. Some of the gloomy instrumentals on side two of Low were rumored to have been, you know, rejected music from the Man Who Fell to Earth soundtrack. But Bowie said that he only used one element of the music that he was composing for the Man Who Fell to Earth in the song Subterraneans. He used the bass that he came up with while he was doing the Man Who Fell to Earth, but that's it.
Right. That's interesting to know when you, because that Low is a strangely sequenced album where, yeah, all of side one, like amazing bangers, vocals, and all of side two basically is instrumentals, very moody, slow. There's some singing and wailing on some of the songs, but yeah, you could imagine that being the soundtrack for a sci-fi movie. But I do like the sort of Americana, bluegrass kind of banjo-y sound of the John Phillips soundtrack in this movie.
I appreciated how dense the soundtrack was on this film. There is so much music in it that we hear incidentally, like off all the televisions or off radios. Like I saw a list of all the music that's in the movie, and it's like 80 different songs. There's even a Steely Dan song in it.
All right.
They also enlisted a man named Desmond Briscoe to make these electronic atmospheres that were also used very nicely. A lot of the footage on his planet uses that music.
All right. Those scenes, there are several cutaways where David Bowie, his character Newton, has visions of his family sort of slowly dying of thirst on their like arid planet. And the first time we see them, I made a note that it looked like a Teletubbies episode, because they're kind of all walking, holding hands, and it's kind of lush. And then in the subsequent scenes where we see them, it's very, you know, it's like a desert and they're dying of thirst.
I have a couple of questions about the plot that I wasn't quite sure about, and maybe you can help me. What was going on with David Bowie being able to see psychically when Rip Torn was having sex?
So that's something we haven't really addressed. Yeah, Rip Torn is like a stud at the beginning, and we see him, yeah, having sex with a bunch of young students. And in one scene, we see him having like yelling sex. Like he's very aggressive in yelling while they're doing it. And then it cuts to simultaneously Bowie's character in a Japanese restaurant while a sort of kabuki theater performance is happening, and two actors are like having a sword fight, and it's intercut with Rip Torn yelling and having sex with a student. I guess it's a very on the nose sort of representation of the violence of sex, I guess. I wasn't quite sure myself.
Yeah, it's just Bowie wasn't like prying in on other people's private lives as much as he was with Rip Torn.
Yeah.
They seem to have some kind of bond that the movie never really explains. Because he winds up being one of his betrayers.
Right. And I guess it's just one of several scenes where, yeah, Bowie's character has a vision. Like, there's a scene where he sees Rip Torn having sex. He sees some pioneers in a field from, like, 150 years ago. He has these visions of his family on the planet. So I guess for him, as part of his, what, clairvoyance or something? It's not really expanded on in the movie. But we do get to see Rip Torn's penis a couple times, and I was wondering during those scenes how those clean-cut teens from Cracked Actor reacted when they thought they were going to go see, like, hey, it's a cool movie with our favorite rock star. The next thing you know, they're seeing Rip Torn's penis up on a screen.
And one story that I read about this tough evening where there was a group of Hell's Angels that were camped nearby, and they started harassing the set in because they filmed the movie in New Mexico. And it says here that Rip Torn was apparently on some sort of alcohol or drug-induced mania and had to be constantly looked after. Bowie was staying up all night and took to snorting no-dos to be alert during filming. The person insisted that it was no-dos that he was snorting.
So that's like a trucker stimulant kind of thing, yeah, to keep you from falling asleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and did the Hell's Angels ever sort of like threaten anyone with violence, or
assume there was a happy ending because I didn't hear how it ended. I just know that it was a rough night because apparently Rip Torn wanted to go after them.
So everyone but Candy Clark was a total mess during the making of this movie.
Yeah, to my knowledge, Rogue never beat up David Bowie or wrestled him to the ground or anything at any point. Apparently, they got along very well.
Well, at least there's that.
They respected each other as artists, I guess.
I guess, yeah, Bowie was very well prepared. Candy Clark has been on an interview saying that he was always up for running lines. And one of the people from the set said that he was like afraid to improvise and that they would do multiple takes of scenes and that he would do like everything exactly the same, every movement and like every line delivery, exactly the same take after take, because he was afraid to change anything.
Yeah. It's a great performance, except, you know, it's not really acting in many ways. But the persona is a Bowie persona.
Yeah.
The movie seems to have been designed around David Bowie to be David Bowie in many ways. Like, you can tell that he's not, like, the strongest actor, but it's still a terrific performance.
I mean, it's the perfect role for someone who's just completely blocked on massive amounts of drugs. He doesn't have to interact or react to anybody. He doesn't have to, he can just sort of be distant and in his own world. And that works because he's a damn alien. So,
yeah, he's like an alien Howard Hughes. And so, you know, if that's the state that he has to be in.
Apparently the rest of the cast and crew stayed in a hotel, but Bowie had a house rented in New Mexico, wherever they were shooting. And he had this massive like trunk. He had like a portable library that was shipped and that like followed him everywhere around the world where he went. And he would just stay in and eat cocaine and read books.
He had a diet of milk and red peppers, and he had feeding times too. He ate at 4 a.m. and 5 a.m.
That combination just seems like absolutely revolting. I know he wasn't in his right mind, but even so, drinking a glass of milk right now, I feel like I would barf. It's just in that desert heat. Come on. I think he was 90 or 95 pounds at his thinnest during this period. And there is a scene where Candy Clark's character, Mary Lou, first meets Bowie, where he gets sick in the elevator because I guess he hasn't adjusted to Earth gravity.
Yeah.
And she has to carry him down the hall. And I bet, I don't know, it seems like he would be easy to carry at that point.
I did read that they had an apparatus to make it look like she was carrying him, but
it
is a plausible theory for sure.
Here's my question. Do you think that Beefeater Gin sponsored this film, because there's quite a lot of Beefeater Gin and shots of the bottle and the logo.
It's quite possible. I read that this was actually the first British film with a British crew to film in the United States. So maybe Beefeater got in on the sort of branding opportunities for the UK.
Interesting. Yeah, it's fun that he, as an alien, he becomes addicted to gin. And this movie could be read as a sort of like a stark warning about the perils of gin. Like, what's that Hogarth painting, Gin Alley? It's like a 1970s sci-fi update on, yeah, the gin craze and the perils of gin.
Gin and television. This movie indicts TV as a real problem.
I mean, it is a, to look at it of like what the story is of like this, a story about this like noble alien who comes with a, you know, like a noble purpose to save his family, and is distracted by just like the garbage of the modern world of like alcohol and a wall of televisions like Elvis and sort of empty sex. He gets distracted from his purpose and never achieves his goal. And because of that, either his family dies or he never sees them again. And it's kind of, it could be, I don't know. I find sometimes like there's that scene where he's watching the wall of TVs. Seeing that, I was like, oh, that's like an afternoon when I lose an afternoon to like spending too much time on Twitter or something like that. Like it's very relatable. The idea of being distracted by just the, you know, the garbage of civilization.
Yeah. These are the things that keep the Manifold Earth very fresh in this day and age. Like, you know, even the World Enterprises Corporation stuff felt like, you know, this movie really did predict some bad future. This movie was really prescient in predicting the sort of, you know, consumer culture that would only get worse with time. It's also important to say that this movie did heavily influence the next couple of albums that Bowie made. Station to Station, the character of the Thin White Duke is basically an extrapolation of the character from The Man Who Fell to Earth, and the album cover was shot in his spaceship from the movie.
Right. And even the cover of Low, I think, is a still from,
yes,
from The Man Who Fell to Earth. So like all these things, Cracked Actor, Man Who Fell to Earth, Station to Station, and Low are all like very interconnected.
Low also then transitions into the next interesting phase of Bowie's career, which is his Berlin trilogy. You can also throw in The Idiot by Iggy Pop in there too.
Right. And these taken as like a whole, like from the Diamond Dogs tour to him moving to Berlin, it's like Cracked Actor shows his sort of attempt to break America. He conquers it. He then does Young Americans, does this movie, Station to Station. Then he transitions almost unrecognizably into this like European, the Berlin years of David Bowie, where he's, you know, hanging out with Neu and Kraftwerk and stuff. So it's in that, I think, two year period, he's gone through this amazing metamorphosis.
And he and Iggy Pop decided to move to Berlin to kick drugs. One of the smartest decisions anyone ever made.
At the time, the heroin capital of Europe. Yes.
Michael, you discovered something very interesting when Bowie first arrived in Europe and was living in Switzerland.
Right. So after after Bowie passed, I forget which new sort of biography came out. But anyway, there was a story that in the late 70s, I guess after his Berlin period, or maybe during the same time, Bowie had a home in Switzerland for tax shelter reasons, and there was no one around except his neighbor was legendary actor Roger Moore. And there's this anecdote that like there was one day David Bowie didn't know anyone. There was a knock at the door. Oh my God, it's Roger Moore, James Bond himself. The two guys hung out. They got drunk. Roger Moore told all of his showbiz stories. David Bowie couldn't believe his luck. He lives next to Roger Moore. The next day, same time as the previous night, knock on the door. It's Roger Moore. David Bowie lets him in. Roger Moore tells the same stories that he did the first night. Not as fun anymore. And then this pattern just kept repeating, where every night at like 5:30 p.m., Roger Moore would knock on David Bowie's Swiss mansion door, to the point where David Bowie just turned off the lights and pretended he wasn't home and like hid under a table so he wouldn't have to have like a very boring conversation with Roger Moore.
Wow. Which is even more incredible because A View to a Kill in 1985, the bad guy in that movie was originally designed to be David Bowie. It was going to be David Bowie and Grace Jones.
Oh, wow.
They wound up with Christopher Walken, who they dyed his hair blonde to play Max Sorin. But that was originally designed to be Bowie.
And did he turn down the role, Bowie? Or did was he?
Maybe when he found out Roger Moore was going to be in it, he said no.
He's like, oh, I can't. I don't want to be sitting with him during pauses in shooting. My God.
Michael, now that I've got you as my guest, I wanted to talk with you about something that I'm very obsessed with. I don't know if we want to talk about it without Terrence.
My brother, about
Kumail.
Oh, okay. I'm willing to go there. But you might want to, have Terrence on in the future to fact check anything I say.
Can you explain to the listener who Kumail is? Because I love Kumail.
So I am ethnically part Slovak on my father's side. The family comes from Slovakia. And just occasionally I'll just like Google like what's the news in Slovakia, and it's always like, I don't know, something about a new barn is opening or something. It's sort of a backwards country. But in Bratislava, the capital city, I stumbled upon some public art, and the most famous sculpture in downtown Bratislava is a sculpture called Kumail, the sewer worker, and it's like a golden sculpture of a man emerging from a manhole from the sewer, who is just sort of like resting on his elbows and looking up. And people think it's either a tribute to like to the workers of Slovakia, or that he is looking up a woman's dress. It's unclear exactly what the purpose of Kumail is. But anyway, if you look up Kumail, C-U-M-I-L, you'll see all sorts of pictures of him, people posing next to him, leaving flowers, beside him and stuff like that. And it is, my brothers and I, it is our goal to eventually visit Bratislava and meet Kumail and have our pictures taken with him.
Kumail is just a remarkable work of public art, because when it snows, then Kumail's covered in snow.
Yes.
If a pigeon lands on Kumail's head, like, that's a photo right there.
Absolutely. He's, some cities build statues to great men. Others build statues of a man climbing out of the sewer. And it makes me proud to be Slovak.
Do you think that Kumail has any influence on modern politics in Slovakia? Like, do you think there's like, the way there's like a Joey Lunchpail voter, like a soccer mom, like that there's the Kumail voter that they're trying to appeal to, and that like political movements could start forming around the Kumail statue?
I mean, based on his sort of his class interests, if we're looking at, he's a worker, he's a blue collar guy. I would hope that he would be embraced by, socialists. And I believe if he was alive, I would hope he was a socialist kind of guy. But Eastern Europe seems to have a problem with a lot of far right politics and, far right soccer hooligans and populists and very xenophobic politics. So it's hard to say where Kumail would lie or which sort of group of people would embrace him.
I'd be more worried about how Kumail would be used in right. politics, like for the way the anti-lockdown people, appropriate right. sort of like, leftist language when pushing actual reactionary politics.
Well, I know that in France, for instance, the far right has sort of appropriated the image of, Joan of Arc as like the true embodiment of France. And so Joan of Arc has become associated with, xenophobia, racism, far right politics. And I would be very disappointed and, disturbed if the far right did that with Kumail.
Isn't there another statue near Kummel of a paparazzi?
So there is.
There's another statue of a paparazzo around the corner from Kummel. Tell our listeners about that guy.
So there's a statue of a guy sort of like poking around the corner with like a long lens camera, snapping a shot at a celebrity who presumably has visited Bratislava, which doesn't seem like something that's actually ever happened in history. But you can also look up this paparazzo.
But the paparazzo is near Kummel? Is it like a sort of square of statues?
See, I've never been to Bratislava.
I don't want to send any Bratislava tourists on a wild goose chase trying to find these two.
I feel like they're probably, I don't think it's that big of a city, so they're probably not too far away from each other. There's also, I know, a statue of Napoleon and one of a legendary sort of like homeless man who walked around in a top hat and tails, but had lost his mind, and everyone sort of just like protected him from the elements. But there's a statue for every taste in Bratislava.
I only passed through Bratislava on a train heading towards Prague from Budapest. I did see a lot of trains carrying giant ammonia containers.
Huh. I wonder if that's Slovakia's main export or import.
Maybe they were cleaning Kummel and they needed extra ammonia.
It needs to be thoroughly cleaned every morning.
Well, he's a pretty filthy guy. He's coming out of the sewer. Speaking of Kummel, I also wanted to talk to you about Glurpo. Have you been following Glurpo?
Glurpo, the underwater clown. Yes, yes. I saw you tweeting about that, and I read a bit about Glurpo. How did you discover Glurpo?
Just being on Twitter. Just because I live on weird Twitter most of the time. And so, you know, inevitably Glurpo, things like Glurpo suddenly show up on my feed. But Glurpo really struck a chord with me. I never really thought about underwater clowns before. There's no, like, you would think that it's impossible to be an underwater clown.
Yeah, did he have special, like, water-resistant makeup or like a wig really like stapled to his head so it didn't float off or something?
And children wanting to see a clown underwater, like, aren't clowns scary enough?
Yeah, Jesus. I did, after seeing you tweet about it, I Googled Glurpo and I read that he also occasionally had a companion, a female underwater clown called Glurpette. And they would have picnics. They would blow smoke rings, which I assume are just bubbles of water, and they would do little tricks for it said both children and adults.
This was deep in the heart of Texas, I think. Glurpo. Right. Glurpo, I don't think, is still a working clown though. This was a few decades ago, I believe. I'm not sure if there's a modern Glurpo. These were like vintage photos of Glurpo that I saw.
Here's a documentary that needs to be made. Track down the descendants of Glurpo and tell Glurpo's story, you know?
Cracked Glurpo, maybe?
I wonder if Glurpo was around today. You asked me about the statue of Kummel's politics. What do you think Glurpo's politics would be? Keeping in mind that he's a Texas clown, do you think he would have been a MAGA guy, or is he a democratic socialist?
Well, considering that President Trump, and I use the word president in air quotes because he wasn't really elected, he's a bit of a clown in my opinion. And so I would think Glurpo would be drawn to a fellow clown.
Right.
Plus he's in Texas.
I could see, had Glurpo still been alive, you know, Trump gave a presidential medal to a dog. I can see him giving one to Glurpo and maybe Glurpette.
Oh, and also, speaking of Glurpo's politics, I see here from the Texas State University archives that Glurpo once ran for state president in San Marcos, Texas.
Hey.
He was Texas's first underwater candidate.
What an achievement.
And it also mentions that he was the world's only underwater clown. What I don't see, though, are the results of that election.
Right. How many votes did Glurpo get?
Was there a runoff vote you know, was it like a two-person race at that point?
Did they
it
check,
doesn't say.
Did they check voter IDs to make sure there was no voter fraud, you know?
And Glurpo, he promoted himself as the world's only underwater clown. So there's actually no other place on the planet where you can find an underwater clown.
Now, did he have a oxygen tank or a snorkel? Because in the picture I saw, he was just a guy submerged in water with makeup on. How long could he perform without having to surface for air?
It doesn't say here. It does say, though, that the clowns were known for interacting with both children and adults in the submarine theater.
Imagine
so
being an
they
adult.
They performed in some kind of environment. It doesn't indicate whether the audience was also underwater or whether they were looking at a big tank with Glurpo in it.
Man, imagine like the today's performance of Glurpo the clown has been canceled because he drowned. He drowned, y'all.
Our thoughts and prayers are with Glurpette today. It's also the name Glurpo is hilarious.
It's the perfect name, yeah. I think of, yeah, swallowing or just, you know, yeah, breathing out underwater.
But yeah, you just assume that you've seen it all, and then you find out that there was an underwater clown named Glurpo. The world is just full of mystery and wonder.
Yeah. I mean, I was scared of, like a lot of kids, I was scared of clowns as a kid, and seeing those pictures of Glurpo, it just adds a new layer of terror to the whole clown idea.
Clowns are huge these days. They just announced they're making a sequel to the movie called The Joker from a couple of years ago.
All right.
I guess it made enough money that they're making Joker Part 2.
They should. I wish that there was just some like really cheap knockoffs of like small studios trying to cash in on the Joker craze, making movies. Yes. Like Glurpo or like the Laffer or something where it's like a very obvious knockoff. Oh, speaking of clowns, I was watching some, if we're done with Bowie, that's okay. But I was watching his 1979 SNL appearance where he brought
Klaus Nomi on.
Klaus Nomi, the original German freak clown, yes.
Yeah.
And they sang The Man Who Sold the World, TVC 15, and Boys Keep Swinging, which was censored for the line where he says, when you're a boy, other boys check you out.
Yes.
That line was censored.
Saturday Night Live is a lot edgier now than they used to be. They were a lot more timid back then. But
yes. Today, you can say anything. You can really attack the powerful. But yeah, Nomi, Klaus Nomi and David Bowie and another like downtown New York cabaret performer did three songs on SNL. And it's good, but it's amazing to see Bowie inject that kind of, yeah, German cabaret feel into SNL, hosted that episode by Martin Sheen.
Wow. Did Bowie do any mime on SNL that night, or was it just German cabaret?
Maybe it was cut. I mean, he's carried out by Klaus Nomi in a like plastic tuxedo, and then for two songs he wears that, and then for Boys Keep Swinging he's a big head with an animated body, and he's kind of doing stuff with his arms, so it's sort of mime like.
Michael, this has been wonderful talking to you about this very, very strange stretch of Bowie's career that is just full of stories. I love it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. It's been fun to go back and watch these two movies and listen to all the music and read about all the insanity during that period.
Michael, do you want to tell our listeners about your upcoming projets?
Sure. So, you can follow me on Twitter at M Balazzo or my current podcast, The Landlord and Tenant Pod Mess, which is a comedy podcast I do with my friend James Hartnett. Just funny interviews with creative people, and we do some little skits. But me and James Hartnett and our comedian friend Chris Locke are gearing up to unleash a new comedy podcast called Evil Men at the end of June. And it's a show that loosely will look at different rude dudes and bad guys throughout history, and just sort of like, you know, have fun and riff on them, give some information, learn a bit. We have a few episodes already recorded on people like Colonel Tom, Elvis's manager, Jeffrey Dahmer, and Gargamel. So look out for that.
That'll be later in June.
At the end of June, yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Michael. This was so much fun. Please come back.
Thank you so much for having me. I'd love to come back. And next time you bring the cocaine, because I brought the cocaine this time.
That concludes this episode of Junk Filter, but we'll have another episode in the next few days. Please like and subscribe to the show if you're enjoying it. Please tell your friends. Please follow us on Twitter at Junk Filter Pod. If you're really enjoying the podcast, we do have a Patreon, and you can get access to bonus episodes by signing up at patreon.com/junkfilter. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you so much for listening.
Week has passed me so slowly. The days fell on their knees. Maybe I'll take something to help me. Hope someone takes after me. There's always a change in the weather. This time I know we could get it together. If you would stay here tonight, oh, that would be crazy tonight. Stay. That's what I meant to say, or do something. But what I never say is stay this time. I really meant to.